And now session 4 of The Wisdom of Your Cells, Perception and Survival with Dr. Bruce Lipton.
Our third conclusion is an interesting one because it deals with the concept of evolution. Evolution means that, look, environments change, and since organisms are adapted to the environment, if an environment changes, to survive, an organism must change its structure or die in the process of trying to change, because if it can't accommodate the new environment, it will certainly not be able to thrive in that environment. Well, the issue is, well, how do mutations occur? Because remember, mutations are the events that change the blueprint genes that can change the structural parts of our body so we can use different versions of those in different environments. How do mutations occur? What I was teaching, and the conventional teaching that is in grade school, high school, college, is the concept that mutations are random events. That when we have something called a cancer, it's a random event. That something just happened to us. We're a victim of random events again. And this is based on the fact that, how did we study mutations? Well, we study mutations as a result of changing the genetic code. Yeah, but when do these mutations occur? Conventional understanding reveals this. When a cell is going to divide into two daughter cells, you have to take the billions of the ATs and Cs and Gs that make up the genetic code, copy them precisely, and pass to each daughter a complete identical set of genes. And in so doing, then each daughter cell will propagate the same components that its mother cell had, and this keeps everything the same. However, in copying the DNA, the copy process occasionally results in a miscopying of the DNA. It's essentially like in the old days, before we had the printing press, monks would take a Bible and sit down with pen and paper and copy that Bible onto a new book. And of course, inevitably, in copying the thousands and thousands and thousands of words that are present in the Bible, inevitably there'll be an error, a spelling error, a word would drop out, and this would have profound consequences on the new version of the Bible because the meaning would be altered. So, for example, by just screwing up with one letter, you can change celebrate into celibate, and celibate means completely something very different than celebrate. And yet, what was reality? By making a simple error in the translation of that original code, the new reading could be totally altered in its meaning. So, when cells are copying their DNA, there's a physical device that actually goes through and copies all these bases, the A, T, C's, and G's, in the right sequence to make an exact copy. Inevitably, because you're copying billions of these coded letters, mistakes happen. A wrong letter gets in. But a wrong letter in the code will lead to a change in the amino acids, making that beaded pop bead sequence called the protein. And if you change the amino acid in a sequence, you change the knitting structure of the protein. So a mutation, which is a change of the DNA code, can lead to a protein with an altered structure, and as a result of an altered structure, may not function appropriately. These kinds of mutations are called spontaneous random mutations, meaning it wasn't the intention of the cell to make a mutation. The intention of the cell was to copy it with fidelity, copy the DNA to make two copies, one to go in each daughter cell. It was never the intention to make the mistake. When a mistake occurs, it's random, meaning it was no particular reason why this particular base pair was changed for another, like you change a G for a T. What, you know, it would just accidents happen like that, random. In this understanding, then it says that evolution, the reason why we're here today, is the net result of billions of years of accidents in DNA reading and writing. basically, it's sort of like we got here like shaking genetic dice, that every now and then you shake the dice and you get a different answer, and all of a sudden you change the proteins and then you get a different organism. So we talk about evolution as a slow, gradual process, the result of spontaneous, random mutations that lead to changes in the structure of the proteins, which lead to changes in the structure and function of the organism, and that over the billions of years, evolution is a result of just fortuitous accidents among random mutations. And so why this becomes relevant is a couple of very important reasons. One of them is basically, if you ask a question, what is the purpose of life? And you start with the premise that it was all an accident, then you must have to unfortunately conclude there is no purpose to life. And as a result, too many people have been really believing that we walk this planet just totally by accident. While they're here, it's like, cool, do whatever you want. You're an accident anyway, and there you go, you're done. And whatever you did to the Earth is a footprint that you made. And why this becomes relevant is that it separates us from the environment as not having any purpose or connection with our environment. We just got here by a series of accidents. Through epigenetic mechanisms, we reveal now that a lot of the changes are not accidents at all, that they're actually designed by the environment. But how can we account for that? Because our conventional understanding is the mutations were just copying errors. Well, it's real interesting because the more biologists looked into this copying mechanism, the more they started finding something that was really an unknown support system, which is now recognized, and it's called repair mechanisms. It says that when the DNA is copied, all the nuclei have enzymes in their proteins whose function it is to compare the old DNA with the new copy. And if a mistake has occurred, it will repair it. So here's a surprising point. We attribute all of our evolution to these random accidents and then come to find that these spontaneous random mutational events are almost always covered and repaired for by the repair mechanism. So all of a sudden it says, well, that then makes it less likely that all the accidents that led to evolution got here by simple random processes, because there was a mechanism to avoid that, to maintain fidelity, that when the daughter cells divide, they pass on equal amounts of information and the same information they receive from the parent cell. So it turns out there was some doubt about as, well, how can you get evolution if we have a repair mechanism? Well, interestingly enough, there was a major paper, which I believe ultimately down the line is going to net John Cairns, a geneticist from Great Britain, a Nobel Prize. When he first wrote this paper, the paper was in the 1988 journal Nature. The title of the article was On the Origin of Mutants. And John Cairns did this amazing study. He took bacteria that had a mutated enzyme. The enzyme is the protein. It's mutated because the gene was altered. And so when it made this enzyme and the enzyme folded up in the right configuration, the structure was incorrect because of the mutation and it didn't work. The enzyme is called lactase. Lactase is a protein enzyme whose job it is to bind to a signal, lactose. And when binding to the signal, the lactase enzyme changes its shape and breaks the lactose down in a process of digestion. So that's actually how the enzyme works. The lactase enzyme has a place to bind lactose. When this lactose, the signal shows up, remember, a signal binds to a protein, causes the protein to change shape. In this case, as the protein changes shape, it breaks the lactose molecule into subunits, which then are later broken down into building blocks by the cell. And so the cell can eat lactose, digest it, and get energy and building blocks from this digestion process. But Cairns starts with bacteria where this enzyme doesn't work because it's mutated, so it can't digest lactose. He puts these bacteria in the petri dishes where the only nutrient is lactose. Well, if you were one of those bacteria, you'd find this to be a very threatening environment. Essentially, you'd be like thrust in the middle of the Gobi Desert with no food to eat anywhere. All the lactose you're standing on, you can't use because the enzyme that you have, lactase, doesn't work. The net result of such an experiment, the anticipation of the result, is nothing will happen. The cells will not grow. They may not die, but they won't grow. And the reason why they won't grow is simply this. To grow and to divide, cells need to take in metabolites, digest them, and then use the energy to double the organism. So a single cell will actually double itself to create two cells which separate from each other. But in these bacteria, you put them in a petri dish, and the medium is lactose. Their enzyme lactase doesn't work. They can't digest it, so they can't get metabolic building blocks, and they can't get energy, so they are not really allowed to divide. So nothing should be growing in any of the petri dishes. Yet, in a large number of the dishes, Cairns found that bacteria started growing colonies. And he said, well, wait a minute, how can that happen? The only way that can happen is if the enzyme was now working. So somehow or other, some condition pushed the enzyme into working. So the conventional thought is, well, all mutations are random. So Cairns wanted to verify in all the petri dishes, every time he did the experiment, are the mutations random? Meaning this, if I look at the mutations in petri dish 1, are they different than the bacteria have in petri dish 2, which are different from the bacteria that are alive in petri dish 3? If I compare them, if all mutations are random, then there should be random results in each one of these experiments. So the first thing he did is he looked at the types of mutations. There are 6 or 7 different ways that DNA can be mutated. When he looked at the experiments, he found that all of the cells that survived used the same type of mutation. So right away, that was like, oh, wait a minute. If it was random, they should have been different kinds of mutations in one dish versus found in a different dish. And yet all of them had the same type of mutation. So that didn't fit the hypothesis. The other thing was the hypothesis is that mutations would be random scattered throughout the genome so that the bacteria in the stressful environment maybe just mutates a lot of genes and that fortunately in the ones that survived, they corrected the mutation by another mutation of the lactase enzyme and that's how they survived. But when Cairns looked at where the genes were that were mutated in the genome, they found that almost all the mutations were focused around just the lactase gene. Well, this completely shocked him because it was completely unexpected on the basis of our normal understanding of mutations. A, they weren't random, and B, the bacteria, the most primitive organism on the planet, essentially, didn't just randomly pick any gene to mutate. It identified the gene where the stress was and mutated that gene. And so Cairns writes this over the fact that the environment led to a stress that directed the mutation to occur and repair the lactase enzyme. And how could it do this when the cells weren't dividing? And this was like the big shock. It found out that our conventional thought was the only time DNA is copied or changed is when the cell is dividing. That's when you're, of course, doubling the DNA. But Cairns found that when an organism is stressed, it doesn't divide at all. But it does activate some genes to copy themselves and make lots of copies, but using a special protein to copy the DNA. That what's unique about this protein is that it's error prone, meaning every time it copies the gene, it puts error into it. It's not the same DNA copying mechanism that is used when a normal cell is dividing and it wants to have two daughter cells exactly the same. The copying enzymes for the DNA assure in that case that both copies are exactly the same as the original and the new are going to be exactly the same because I want both daughter cells to have exactly the same DNA. But in a stress situation, when it identified that the genes associated with lactose metabolism weren't working right, the cell selected those genes to be copied, but by an enzyme that induced mutations. So it's a completely different event. The organism is making mutations with an intention. The reason is this. The current gene doesn't work, so keeping that just the same way will keep me in the same problem. So it uses a mechanism to copy the gene and induce errors. So there's a process where you amplify the number of genes by copying them, but you hypermutate them, meaning that every copy will be slightly different than the original one. And then when you get large numbers of these genes, any of the gene that has been copied and the error corrected will then make an enzyme that can be used. And the one that can make a new version with a working lactase, that new version is actually put into the chromosome. The old non-functional copy of the gene is cut out, and the new copy with the modified version is put in. And he wrote this article talking about how mutations are not necessarily random, that mutations are influenced by the stresses that the organism perceives in the environment, and that the stresses directly select which genes are the problem genes, and the system has a mechanism to actually generate mutations. And this is like a 180-degree difference from our conventional point of view that all mutations are accident and random. This says that mutations can be selected and purposeful. Well, when he published the article in 1988, I loved it because the journal editors, they didn't want to publish the article because this completely pulls the rug out of our conventional understanding of evolution and Darwin's theories that life is not maybe random. And the British, they couldn't not put the article in for this reason. When John Cairns did this research, he was already a world-recognized leader in genetics. So the editors couldn't really say, well, we're not accepting the article because obviously this is false and your work is questionable. They couldn't say that. So they published the article, but they did put an editorial in the journal. And it's interesting because the British have a sense of humor. And the title of the editorial, which came right after the paper, was A Unicorn in the Garden. And in that British sense of humor, it meant a unicorn was a fantasy, the garden was the biosphere. And what they said was, well, we published this work, we have grave doubts that it's real. And it's a fantasy. It just can't be because we obviously know we live in a Darwinian world based on random mutations. The concept that an organism, especially something as primitive as a bacterium, can change its genes with any kind of intelligence just didn't fit. It was interesting because 1 week later, the American Journal Science wrote an editorial that slammed Cairns' work. And it's just wonderful because the Yanks, they didn't express that sense of humor. Their editorial was big, bold, black letters that says, a heresy in evolutionary biology. And they just claimed that it was unthinkable that anybody could really believe that bacteria could change their genetics in response to the stresses they have in their environment. They just said that was the most unlikely possibility of all, and they just tore a big one for Mr. John Cairns. But the interesting thing about it is John Cairns' work was right, that it's taken a number of years, but we finally have come along to understand that there are mechanisms that cause mutations when an organism is stressed, and that these mechanisms are involved with rewriting the genetic code to upgrade the organism to fit the environment that they're in. The relevance about this is very important because it really says that we are not here by randomness. We're here by an intention and purposeful design of nature. That this is not an accident, that we are an integral part of the environment, adjusting ourselves continuously with the environment as all other organisms do. This kind of evolution is not Darwinian at all. It's actually Lamarckian evolution. And it's interesting because most people don't even know of Jean-Baptiste de Lamarck. Lamarck is a French biologist who published his theory of evolution in 1809, 50 years before Charles Darwin. Lamarck's theory of evolution was the first scientific theory of evolution. It was usurped by Darwin and not recognized. He didn't identify where he got his information from, but it was usurped by Darwin. And yet Lamarck had an interesting theory. He was the first one, A, to identify that evolution occurred. But in regard to mechanisms, he suggested the following. He suggested that organisms change as a result of the parents experiencing the world they live in, finding it somewhat stressful, and then changing the genetics of their offspring so that the offspring will be better adapted to live in the environment. Lamarck called this the inheritance of acquired characteristics, that an organism would acquire a characteristic by dealing with the environment and then pass that characteristic on to their offspring. There was an experiment in the early part of the 1900s by a German scientist, August Weismann, who wanted to slam Lamarck on this because he didn't believe Lamarck. He said, no, environmental alterations cannot be passed on to their offspring, because Weismann found that germ cells, the cells that form sperm and egg, separate from the body cells real early in development. And so his premise was this: since the germ cells are already separated from the body, if the individual's body experiences something and changes something in its genes, it wouldn't go back to the germ cells because the germ cells were already separated from the body cells, so that their programs would be unaffected by the life of the individual who carried those germ cells. So Weismann did this experiment. He said, if Lamarck is right and the environment influences the expression of heredity, then he said, if I cut the tails off of mice and then mate these tailless mice with each other, the environmental influence of cutting the tails off should be acquired by the offspring. They should inherit this so that the offspring of these mated tailless mice should be tailless. Well, of course, he did the first run of experiments and he mated them, and the offspring had tails. So he said, well, I'll give it the benefit of the doubt here. He ran the experiment 21 times, taking the offspring from one set of experiments, mating them, cutting their tails off, then mating them, and then cutting the offspring from that cross, cutting their tails off and mating them 21 times, 21 generations. At the end of 21 generations, he stopped the experiment saying, look, every time I cut the tails off, I mate the mice and the new babies all have tails. Lamarck has to be wrong. None of these mice inherited taillessness. There's only one problem, of course. We bought the experiment and wrote Lamarck off, but in hindsight, there was one big flaw in all this, or actually a couple of big flaws. One of them, Lamarck said evolution took thousands of years. So 21 generations is not really an accurate experiment. If Weismann would do it for 1,000 years, maybe in 1,000 years, actually, tailless mice may have been born. That's possible. But another flaw in the experiment was this. Lamarck said that traits that were no longer necessary, or traits that were ineffective, would be the ones that would be altered. Just because Weismann thought the tails and the mice were not necessary didn't reflect the fact that maybe the mice thought the tails were necessary. So his cutting off the tails didn't affect the heredity, because the tails play a useful functional part in the life of the mouse. So for those two reasons, Weismann's experiments are really not very good science, yet people were already desirous to prove Charles Darwin's theory, and that was a competing theory. So when Weismann did this experiment, it said, okay, let's get rid of Lamarck, and now we're left with Darwinian theory, which is the theory based on chance, versus Lamarck, who had a completely different theory and said organisms and their environment are in a lockstep interaction. As the environment changes, so will the organism to accommodate those changes, so that evolution was an interactive process between the organisms on the planet and the environment, and it was a dynamic, instructive event. Well, since that time where we got rid of Lamarck and made a buffoon, everyone used to talk about Lamarck as the crazy guy who suggested that fish are at the edge of the pond and daydreaming about the fact that if they could get legs, they could walk out there. And that's the old Lamarck joke, a fish pondering the idea of legs and wishing itself to have legs. And this was what was attributed to Lamarck, when Lamarck never said that. And it was interesting, because Lamarck's study on the relationship of the environment, he also said something that was very critical back in 1809. So that was, almost 200 years ago, he said this very precisely. He said that the more humans separate themselves from nature, the greater will be our disruption and social loss. And it's interesting, because this is exactly where we've come from, because buying into the Darwinian theory says that everything was an accident, that nothing was really connected with anything else. It was just a matter of genes accidentally being misread, providing for different organisms. And we have essentially divorced ourselves from the environment. We have done that both through the church, who said, oh, man was put on top of this planet after everything was here, so that everything was here for us to mess around with. And biology continued that separation by saying, well, you got here by accident. There was no purpose for you to be here. So that's just the way it is. And we're all a bunch of random people in a random world. And yet what we're really beginning to find out is that this is not really true. that evolution is involving a very, very big and major cooperative effort among and within all of the organisms on this planet. Timothy Lenton, an evolutionary biologist from Great Britain, has revealed very interesting data that, in fact, evolution is not based on Darwinian competition where there's a struggle and the survival of the fittest is what's important. That Lenton reveals that evolution is based totally on cooperation, that nature itself doesn't really care who's the strongest in any particular group. Nature cares what the group does. So while in our Darwinian mind, we look for who's going to be the strongest human, and in nature's mind, what are humans doing to the planet? Those are two different events. And the issue is that because as a group, we have been consistently destroying the planet, nature has a vision that says that anything that doesn't fit in harmony with the environment has to be removed from the environment. And unfortunately, we are deep into our sixth mass extinction because of the exact problem that Lamarck warned us about. We cannot separate ourselves from the environment. We are the environment. We are not separate from anything in the environment. In order for us to survive, we need bacteria. As a matter of fact, right now, well, wherever you are, you have bacteria in your gut that are not you. They're from the outside. But without them, you wouldn't live. These bacteria not only provide fundamental nutrients and vitamins to our survival, these bacteria even control the genes that are active in your gut cells. We live in a community. Everything is a community, except our human hubris has us sitting on top, saying that we're in charge of everything and we can do what we want. That hubris itself is responsible for the problems that we have, in addition to the Darwinian theory, which says that this is all a struggle and that survival of the fittest is what counts in a world where it's based now, where you recognize on cooperation and not competition. We also recognize something very, very new that's very important in regard to the concept of genetic engineering. It was our original premise and understanding of DNA that DNA occurs within an individual cell and is not connected to anybody else. That the DNA in you is your DNA and the DNA in some other organism is somebody else's DNA. And what we now recognize is something called horizontal and vertical transfer. That we now recognize that organisms exchange DNA and that this is a normal way of life because DNA represents an acquired learning of the environment and that organisms can pass them among each other so that we can get DNA from one human to another human, but we can also get DNA from organisms that are greatly different species that we find in our human genome. A lot of bacterial genes, that bacteria in our gut are greatly influencing us. Why is this relevant? Because today we're dabbling with genetic engineering, the concept that we can just take any organism out there, and because of our conventional belief, remember that mission statement of science to dominate and control nature, and our ability to change genes, that we can just take any organism and change the genes to create whatever we want. In so doing, we've created a great deal and variety of genetically engineered crops. What we're really not talking about is what is the consequence of putting those crops into the real world? And the answer is through genetic transfer. We now find that the genes that we put into certain genetically engineered organisms are moving through the ecosystem and being picked up by other organisms. That what were efforts to make plants resistant to a poison that was going to kill all the weeds with a special gene that would make the plant immune to that poison, they found that the plants have passed the genes on to all the other plants around them in the field. So that, guess what? We have now created what are called super weeds, weeds that have incorporated those particular immune-conferring genes and no longer can be killed by the normal poisons that are out in agriculture. Again, the point about all this is that genetically engineered organisms are part of a community and share their genes. It has also been recognized that when we eat genetically modified foods, the bacteria in our gut that digest those foods can also pick up and incorporate genetically engineered genes. So we're even changing the genetic organization of the bacteria within our own gut from eating genetically modified foods. Where this is going to lead to, unfortunately, is issues that humans never really expect to find until something hits the wall. So, for example, there was a day when it was great to have all this radioactive material and all this waste matter from nuclear plants. And then somebody said, well, what are you going to do with this stuff? Oh, we're going to put it in concrete bunkers in the ground, and it will last millions of years until the radioactivity is all gone. Only unfortunate part about that is exactly we made the bunkers, but nobody considered the fact that the bunkers over time cracked and all of the radioactivity started leaking back into the environment again. The same thing applies with genetic engineering, where they said, oh, well, these genes are not going to affect this organism. We're now beginning to recognize that the genes are passed from one organism to another. So for us to mess with nature is sort of like throwing a monkey wrench into a highly designed, geared mechanism. We can destroy this whole thing. The problem is we will probably only find out about that destruction when the effects are so bad that they become very obvious to us. Yet we already know that's the direction, and that engineered genes are not restricted to the organism in which they were engineered, but now go out into the field. So we come to this third conclusion about the perception, and that is this: the switches on the surface of the membrane, conclusion one, the switches control the proteins which control our behavior. Number two, the switches control the regulatory proteins of chromosomes, and so the perception switches control which genes are going to be read. And now number three, we recognize that when the perception of the organism identifies stresses it can no longer deal with, then what's going to actually happen is that the perception of the stress will go into the genetics and actually lead to a rewriting of the code via hypersomatic mutation, lead to a change out of the genes in an effort to adjust the organism to accommodate the environment in which it finds itself. So really what it says is perception controls behavior, perception controls activity of genes, and perception even controls the final readout of the genetic code. And all of these become relevant because all of us are dealing with our lives the same way cells do. We are exactly the same. We read the environmental signals via our skin, which is the equivalent of the cell membrane. We adjust our biology, our behavior from those perceptions. We adjust which genes we activate with those perceptions. And unfortunately, because we hadn't known it in the past, that when we are stressed, our perceptions can also lead to a rewriting of our genetic code. And this is problematic considering that 95% or more of us got here with an appropriate genetic code to survive and thrive on this planet. If we rewrite those genes via misperceptions, stresses that we generate that are not really real, but we buy into them, then we'll even change our genetic code. And this comes to very big issues concerning itself with cancer and the expression of cancer in our planet and genetic defects that arise in the life of an individual. And that our genes change from a day-to-day basis on which ones are being read. This is a very interesting result of new studies that also revealed that identical twins, when they're born, essentially have pretty much the same genes being read in their genome. But from day they start living life and experiencing the planet, they start diverging so that the older they get, when you compare their genes, which ones are being read, they become greatly different. That the readout of one twin is going to have a different readout of genes than the other twin. And it's all now recognized to be based on experiences. As we experience life, we change the genes that are being read. And this is nature's sense of survival, because if environments change, you have to change the programs. And so it was built in to do that. So now we have to deal with the concept of perceptions. Perceptions are the mechanism by which an environmental signal is interpreted and then activate a biological function to meet the demand of those perceptions. Well, when we talk about perceptions, we can actually consider perceptions in two fundamental ways. Perceptions, part one, are things. I perceive a microphone that I'm talking into. I perceive a room. I perceive a window. I perceive a rug. Wherever you are, you can perceive things all around you. Perceptions are identities of things. I can perceive things as being this or being that. But what's interesting about perceptions are not just identities, because when we acquire perceptions, we also give them a survival value. That if something is dangerous, I need to know that when I learn it, so if I ever see it again, I enact and do the appropriate response to stay alive. So when we acquire perceptions, we give them values for survival. So then if I say, well, wait a second, perceptions get between the environment and the cells and control the cells. The perceptions are the substance and function of the nervous system. The nervous system is designed to read the environment, integrate all the incoming information, perceptions, and then engage appropriate functional and physiological behaviors to keep us alive in that particular field. So then I say, okay, survival is the primary function of using our perceptions to survive. And I say, well, wait, what does survival really represent? Again, for simplicity, I can divide survival into two fundamental components. Survival can consist of, one, the mechanisms of growth and reproduction, meaning this. In order for you as an individual to survive, you have to grow and keep yourself alive and take care of your system, which is a process called growth. To keep the species alive, you have to reproduce. You actually have to reproduce your own cells just to stay alive. So our survival is very much tied in with growth and reproduction. Now, I'm not talking about the growth that occurs between a neonate and adult. I'm talking about the requirement of this growth and reproduction for your entire life. I don't care how many hundred years old you are, for this simple reason. As I mentioned when we really started this program a long time ago, is that the human body is a community of cells, upwards to 50 trillion cells. Every day, in our normal use, we are losing cells. There's a great attrition. Maybe billions of cells every day are lost because they age, they wear out, they die. Well, that's a very interesting fact because it says, and you must grow every day to replace these cells. If you interfere with growth, if you stop growth, a person can die because there's a point if I start losing too many cells, that attrition will affect some of my functions, causing them to stop functioning, let's say, and causing me to die. So survival is very much tied in with growth every day of our lives just to keep us alive in the face of the number of cells that we lose every day as a result of normal attrition. Okay, so it becomes important that growth is a very, very functional part of our survival. But another part of our survival uses mechanisms other than those used in growth. A completely different set of mechanisms are used for the second component of survival. The second component is called protection. Protection and growth are not the same thing at all. They, as I said, they use completely different mechanisms and for different reasons. Growth is to open up to the outside and take things in, assimilate things, and incorporate them into your life. Protection is completely the opposite. Protection is to shut you down and prevent things that are threatening from the outside from getting in and destroying you on the inside. So I am engaging in both growth and protection mechanisms every moment of my life and funding each of these with energy because it takes energy to grow. It takes energy to protect yourself. But now here comes a very interesting fact. In survival, when we go back into ancient times, yes, there were indeed times you needed protection. To run away from that saber-toothed tiger, for example, required a protection movement. So what would happen is the system was designed to be in growth and then occasionally be in protection for the moment you had to run away from that tiger. But once you ran away from the tiger and you survive, you go back into growth again. Protection cannot be a sustained life event for this very particular reason. When we engage in protection mechanisms, by nature, we have to close ourselves down. That's what protection is all about. And we begin to shut off growth. Nature designed us to use protection in acute responses, again, like running away from the saber-toothed tiger. But if you maintain protection and you keep it for too long, you compromise your survival because in a state of protection, you are actually shutting off the growth mechanisms as you engage in closing yourself down and putting your energy into reserves for fight or flight. And so as a result, what really becomes important is this. How much of our lives are in growth and how much of it is in protection? And here's a simple basic understanding regarding the use of energy. As I mentioned, it takes energy to grow. It takes energy to protect yourself. And the point is this, the more fear that we live in, the more we allocate our energy into protection, but you get that energy by taking it away from growth. So in fact, the more afraid you become, the more you shut down growth, to the extent that this becomes a truism. You can be scared to death. And the reason why that happens is something that promotes so much fear actually can cause your physiology to shut itself down, and you can actually die from being in a protection response. And the issue is that in the world that we live in today, protection response has become a greater and greater percentage of our everyday life experience, to the extent that most of us are living on very high levels of stress and are continuously debilitating our system by interfering with growth. But to talk about that, let's first talk about the relationship between growth and protection using a simple experiment that I saw in my own tissue culture cells, and that's simply this. I take two sets of cultures with cells in them, and I put in one set of culture some food and nutrients in a certain spot on the petri dish. In the other set of cultures, in that very same spot, I put toxins. And now I have these two sets of dishes, and I put them back in the incubator, and I come back hours later and I ask a question, where are the cells going to be? And I bet you can already begin to figure it out. In the dish where the food was, when the cells perceive, which remember is reading the environment, and perceive the nutrients, the cells adjust their biology to move to the food. So wherever the petri dishes are, when I put food in that spot, when I come back, the cells are going to be all gathered around that food and participating in growth. In the parallel set of cultures, I put toxins. But when the perception of the cells reveals the presence of the toxin, rather than moving to the toxin, that perception causes cells to move in the opposite direction, away from it, for protection. So the cells in those dishes are going to be on the far end of the petri dish, away from the source of the toxins, trying to avoid the toxins and stay alive. What's the point? It's simply this. When the perception is recognized to be of things that support growth, the cells will move to the perceptions that support growth. When the perceptions are recognized as things that threaten survival, then the cells will move away from those perceptions. So there's an interesting reality. There are perceptions that cause us to move to them in a state of growth, which is being open so we can assimilate those things. And there are perceptions of things that threaten us, that cause us to be concerned about our survival. And when we perceive those signals, we move away from the signal and close ourselves down. They're diametrically opposed behaviors. One perception, move to the stimulus, arms open, taking it in. The other perception, identify the threatening stimulus, move away from it, and close yourself down in a state of protection. That little simple experiment leads to a very important fact. Cells cannot move in both directions at the same time. That at the level of cells, cells are either in growth, open to the environment and assimilating what's going on, or cells are in protection, shutting themselves down, waiting for the environment to clear itself before again expressing its normal functions. The issue about this is that when we perceive the world that we live in, we interpret the perceptions. As I said, all perceptions are interpreted in regard to identities of things. But we didn't recognize was this. We also attribute to each perception when we learned it a survival value. So if we see something threatening, then our tendency is to move away from it and shut ourselves down. And if we see something that supports what we consider growth, we'll move toward that perception and incorporate it and take it in. Well, this all of a sudden says, well, there's this great A-B kind of switch. You're either in growth or you're in protection. Well, if you're a cell, that's very true, because cells can't move forward and be open and move backwards and be closed at the very same time. And yet, what we do is we live in a community of cells, and the community of cells responds to the perceptions generated by our central nervous system. So it becomes very interesting then that our perceptions are programmed and our cells respond to the programs of perceptions that our central nervous system experiences. So let's go first over the concept of growth and protection and how they're mutually exclusive to each other. And it works like this. I said, cells form a community, and the community is an organism. So we are, in a sense, a large community of individual living cells. But a cell community is just like a community made out of people. So to give the story, then, I'll talk about people, but it's the same for cells. And it goes like this. In the old days, we thought the Russians were going to bomb us. So what did we do? We built bomb shelters. And so let's consider a nice little town where you're living right now, wherever it is, and recognize on a wonderful, you know, spring day, the weather's fine, the plants are growing, the businesses are open, they're doing businesses, the factories are open, they're growing, they're assimilating things and turning them into products, schools are going, education, we're in a state of growth, and everyone is thriving at this moment. But all of a sudden, there's an air raid siren. And when the air raid siren comes, everybody runs to their bomb shelter. Well, I have a couple of questions to ask about this behavior. Number one, if everything was growing when we were engaged in the job, when everybody went to the bomb shelter, what happened to the processes of growth? What about the businesses that were producing and the stores that were open and the schools that were teaching? In the moment of protection, when we all ran to the bomb shelter, growth stopped. There was nobody on the job making things at the factory. School was empty. Businesses were closed. Another important question was this. Yes, we lived in a community open and assimilated with each other, but at the moment that bomb shelter was in sight and the air raid siren was blasting in the environment, if you see your neighbor coming over trying to get in your bomb shelter, many cases were revealed through experiences where this happened, people would shoot their neighbor who was trying to get into their bomb shelter. Why? Protection, everybody out for themselves. Protect yourself. Close yourself off from the outside. So you get into that bomb shelter. You close yourself off from the outside. Well, if it was just an air raid alert, 10 minutes later, okay, you breathe, you get out of the bomb shelter, you go back to the job, the factories start, the school starts, the business, everything's back in order. It was sort of like a 10 or 15 minute coffee break. No problem, just an acute response. I thought it was emergency, everything's cleared up, I'm ready to go again. But here's where the problem comes from. Everybody's on the job, schools are in, all that stuff's going on. The air raid siren goes off, everybody runs to their bomb shelters, they're hiding in their bomb shelter. But here's the problem. There is no all clear signal. The question then becomes very profound and says, how long can you survive? And the answer is, for as long as you can on the nutrients and things you kept in your bomb shelter. Because when you run out of those nutrients, you're going to die if you're in that bomb shelter. And if you have all the nutrients in there and you're not making any new nutrients, why aren't you making any new ones? Because everybody's in the bomb shelter. The factory's closed. We're not making anything anymore. And all of a sudden you start to realize protection can only be used for relatively short periods of time. Because while you're in protection, you've shut down the growth mechanisms. Yeah, but the growth mechanisms fed you with the energy and all the things you needed to stay alive. So while you're in a bomb shelter, growth mechanisms are shut off. And so it turns out, very interestingly, in the world that we live in, that the fears are no longer acute fears that just show up like a saber tooth, which is obviously real scary and I wouldn't want to be running from one of them. But the reality is, if you escape from that saber tooth tiger, you could go back in your life again. But today we have fears that we seemingly can't escape from. Who's Al-Qaeda? Where are they? I have no idea, but they're around. Where's bird flu? It's out there somewhere. Is it around? It's going to get me. And all of a sudden you start to see, we are presented with fears that threaten our survival, perceptions that cause us to consider whether we can stay alive. When we see those perceptions, it causes us to get into a protection posture. Well, what does this mean physiologically? I mean, I talked about the bomb shelter. I physically go into the bomb shelter. I'm disconnected from the world, and I can only stay in there as long as I got nutrients for. Yeah, but what does this mean in my body? If I perceive that the world is threatening, what happens? Well, this is an important story because it affects almost everybody on the planet today. And it deals with how the biology deals with the stress of survival issues. The primary mechanism in dealing with stress in the human body is the adrenal system, which in grade school and high school, we commonly refer to it as the fight or flight mechanism. The adrenal system, upon appropriate stimuli of perceptions that require us to get into protection, release stress hormones to the body that change the physiology and functioning of the body. Well, how does all this get connected? So let's start with the basic protection mechanisms. Let's talk about the fact that we actually have two protection mechanisms and one central growth mechanism. The growth mechanism, all the visceral organs involved with respiration, digestion, excretion, keeping the blood filtered and clean and all that kind of stuff like that. Those are part of our growth mechanisms. We breathe, we take in food, we get metabolites, we get energy, we keep the system clean. That's what we use for growth. Protection mechanisms are actually two different ones. One of them deals with internal threats. One deals with external threats. The mechanisms dealing with internal threats, meaning things that get into our body like viruses, bacteria, parasites, that would have a tendency to eat us from the inside out, or the presence of cancer cells, which will destroy the community that we live in. These threats are dealt with under the skin by a system called the immune system. The immune system deals with anything that gets under the skin that threatens our survival. The adrenal system is another protection mechanism, but it really protects us against things on the outside of our skin. So a poisonous snake, a saber-toothed tiger, an Al-Qaeda renegade, all represent things that are outside of our body that, when perceived, will engage the adrenal system and not the immune system. So, for example, if you had a stomach infection and you were trying to work with it with your immune system and you were being chased by a saber-toothed tiger, your biology would have to decide, how much energy should I put into dealing with the bacterial infection and how much energy should I put toward running away from the tiger? As you could clearly see, that's not a hard question to answer. The obvious answer is you throw everything you can into running away from the tiger, deal with the bacteria later. Well, what controls all this? What controls what happens in response to a stress response? And the answer is a system that is abbreviated as the HPA axis. The HPA axis stands for the following: three organ systems. H is hypothalamus, P is pituitary, and A is adrenal system. How do they interact and work? And it goes like this. The hypothalamus is the portion of the central nervous system that interprets the perceptions. It is involved with reading a perception in the environment and identifying whether it's a perception that encourages growth or requires protection. If the hypothalamus sees something in the environment that is threatening, its job is to communicate to the 50 trillion cells that make up the community called the human body to tell them, listen, there's something out there that's threatening us. We must collectively as a community engage in a response to protect ourselves. So the hypothalamus wants to coordinate the activity of 50 trillion cells to deal with the threat in the environment. So how's that going to happen? The answer is, the H goes to the P, HPA, the pituitary gland, the master gland. So what's the function of the master gland? It is the gland that coordinates the activities of 50 trillion cells. So the hypothalamus says we're being besieged by a threatening situation and sends a signal to the pituitary gland and says, oh my goodness, in this particular threat, it's something from the outside. And so what we're going to have to do is engage fight or flight. That's the adrenal system. That's the A, HPA. So the pituitary gland sends a signal to the adrenal gland to release adrenal stress hormones. So the action so far is this. I'm going through my world. I see something threatening. I interpret it in my brain in my hypothalamus. The hypothalamus says that this is indeed a threat to our survival, sends a signal to the pituitary gland, the master gland, that says, let's coordinate the 50 trillion cells to deal with this threat, which is coming from the outside. The pituitary gland says, okay, in that case, let's bring in the adrenal gland as the primary source of control. The adrenal gland releases stress hormones throughout the body to coordinate 50 trillion cells. Well, let's consider what happens in the first step. The first step is this. If I'm being chased by that saber-toothed tiger and I have to use fight or flight, that means I'm going to depend on my protection by using my arms and legs, either to get into a fight or run away from that threat. Well, to do that, then I'm going to have to fund. Remember, protection requires energy as well as growth requires energy. If I'm going to fund this protection response, then that means I'm going to have to send extra nutrients right away to my arms and legs, because these are the guys that are going to have to carry me. I don't know how far I'm going to go, but I need all of the energy to go to the arms and legs. And the reason is, as I said before, look, I might be putting some of that energy into fighting a bacterial infection, but if I get eaten by the lion, then the bacterial infection is the lion's problem, not mine anymore. But the system's intelligent enough. If you're being chased by the lion, bacterial infection can wait. We'll deal with that later. The system will send the blood to the arms and legs. But listen to this phrase. This is a very interesting phrase out of a textbook. It goes like this. In the presence of the stress hormones, the blood is preferentially sent to the arms and legs. Well, that invokes some kind of thought. Preferentially sending blood to the arms and legs. How do you do something like that? The answer is simple. The stress hormones cause the blood vessels in the gut to constrict. That means as blood is flowing through the system, it no longer goes through the viscera, but is shunted to the outside. So the blood is now preferentially going to the arms and legs. Yeah, because those are the structures I'm going to need to have all that energy available for so I can run away from this thing. Well, it's a very interesting point, because I say, well, wait, the arms and legs are used in protection. What was the role of the viscera? The viscera is growth and maintenance. That's where the lungs and digestive tract and taking care of the blood and taking care of the nutrition, that all occurs in the viscera. Yeah, but if you squeeze the blood vessels so the blood doesn't go into the viscera, that means you are not providing energy, which is carried by the blood, into the viscera, so the viscera shuts down. This is the point I made before. In a state of protection, you shut off growth, because you're allocating all your energy reserves, your blood, to be used by the arms and legs in this particular process of escape. So the very important point that we brought out before about a protection response, it compromises growth. The more stress you're under, the more you shut off your growth mechanisms in an effort to protect yourself by giving nourishment to the adrenal system so that you can do that fight and flight as necessary. Well, it's also interesting because I said the immune system is also affected by this, and this is indeed a fact. And we also find that the stress hormones, when released into the body, not only cause the blood vessels of the gut to constrict, they also cause the immune system to shut off. And the reason for that is very obvious. And the fact is this. If I have energy allocations and, you know, and you're in charge of distributing the energy and you're being chased by a lion, you have to think of how much energy should you put into that bacterial infection, as we discussed before. No, you put all of it into running. So it's very interesting because the medical profession has known for years about the fact that stress hormones shut off the immune system. In fact, it's frequently used when people are recipients of grafts of tissues or organs. These recipients of these foreign tissues are given stress hormones as a mechanism of shutting off their immune system so that they don't reject the grafted foreign tissue. So it's used as a, you know, as a medical process then to help sustain the grafted tissue in a foreign graft in a human by shutting down that individual's immune system and not allowing for the rejection of the graft. But what does this mean in the operation of day-to-day life for all of us? And that says, every day as we are getting stressed, the more stress we're under, the more we begin to shut off the immune system, because the adrenal hormones are very much the element of switching. Those are signals that switch the switches on the immune system to shut them down. So it says this, every day as we experience stress, we're debilitating our immune system. We're shutting its functions down to conserve energy to deal with what appears to be the primary concern, the stress that's outside, the thing that threatens us from outside. Well, this is a very interesting condition for this reason. Every one of us, myself here, you there, right now are infected with almost all the viruses and bacterial pathogens that affect humans. If I took a blood sample from every one of you out there, we'll find that there are bacteria and viruses in it. And yet you might report back to me and say, well, listen, I'm not sick. I'm doing very, very well right now. And what about those infective agents? Well, it's an interesting classification provided to these microbes that are in us by medicine. They're called opportunistic organisms, meaning this: under normal situations, we're infected by these organisms, and under normal situations, the immune system will continuously make an effort to negate the effect of these organisms so they don't get a foothold and take advantage of us. And that we expend a lot of energy in doing that because the world that we live in, every breath that we take is filled with bacteria and yeast and viruses, and our skin is covered with things just walking down the street. We're continuously being bombarded by these threatening things that try to get in to our body and take over the system. Our immune system is, of course, very intelligent and can handle all this, and does so with a great deal of ability of negating these. But it doesn't kill all of them. It can't kill all of them because every time you take a new breath, there's something new coming in. So the issues are, it does its best and it maintains them and keeps them from taking over. But as you get stressed, the stress hormone levels start to elevate. The stress hormones from the adrenal glands will actually start to inhibit and curtail the activity of the immune system, so that all of a sudden these organisms start to get a little bit more breathing room, more free space. They're not being attacked by the immune system as much. That's when these organisms use the name that they've been given, opportunistic organisms. If you cut back the effectiveness of your immune system, these organisms take that opportunity and will then start to manifest problems. And so that as you repress the immune system, common everyday things can start to take over and kill us. In fact, this is really the consequence of why AIDS patients die. They don't die from the AIDS virus. They die from the fact that their immune system is compromised, and these opportunistic organisms, such as the one that provides for pneumonia, go unchecked in this system, and as a result, take advantage of it, take the opportunity, and can kill the individual as a result of this infection. But for those of us that are out there in the real world, every day that we respond to stresses that are picked up by our hypothalamus, are we going to keep this job? Is our paycheck really for real going to be assured to us? Are we going to be invaded by somebody? Is the bird flu going to get me? Whatever these fears are that you are having every day, this is causing the hypothalamus to engage the pituitary gland, to then engage the adrenal gland and prepare us for the protection response at the cost of two things we just recognized. One, shutting down or inhibiting the growth mechanisms of the viscera because we divert the blood. And two, shutting down the immune system as we take the energy that we were using for that and get in a ready state for fight or flight over the fears that we're living in. So those are two very important debilitating events that can threaten us, and most people are very familiar with these, because as we start to find stress in our lives, we start to get weaker, we start to find that sicknesses becomes a way of life the more stress we're under. Kids at school, for example, will start to really get sick more around exam time, because that's the point where the stresses start coming in, and then the fears of passing the exam, which is an external threat, of course, lead to a suppression of the immune system, and then the opportunistic organisms take over. The concept that we have to catch something is very silly in this regard, because it turns out most all of us have already have almost all the pathogens that affect humans in the first place. So the concept of what is the debilitation of stress? The first thing is it prevents the continuous repair of all the cells that are dying every day from normal attrition. That if you inhibit it enough, then there'll be a point where the numbers of cells lost will compromise the functions, and then we'll start to express a dis-ease about that. That the continued stress shuts down the immune system. And as a result of that, the inherent opportunistic organisms we already have will start to take advantage of us. So those are two very great debilitating effects of the stresses and the influence of the HPA axis on our biology. There's one more, a third one, which I usually designate as adding insult to injury consequence. And this is the third aspect of the HPA action that causes us to have a negative consequence. And it goes like this. When you're in a state of adrenal response, you're in a fight or flight response. When you're in a fight or flight posture, think about this. Do you think you use executive reasoning, conscious logic to deal with this, or do you use reflex behavior? And the answer is reflex behavior. It's faster. It's more powerful. Consciousness is slow, that while you're just deliberating about what you should do, you could already be losing in regard if your life is threatened. So, for example, when you're driving a car, you might be driving with your conscious mind, but if you start to get into an accident, you will actually automatically and rapidly respond to this thing using the reflexive behavior of the brain and not conscious action at all, because consciousness is too slow. Well, now let's put this reflex behavior in context. Reflex behavior is hindbrain function. It's the motor coordination part of the back of the brain. Consciousness and thinking part of the brain is the forebrain. Well, here's an interesting thing then. When I get put into fight or flight, I really want to operate from hindbrain reflexes. So it's interesting that when the stress hormones from the adrenal gland are released into the system, remember the first time I said the stress hormones cause the blood vessels in the gut to constrict, causing the blood to preferentially go to the periphery. Well, it's interesting because the very same hormones, when they get in the brain, cause the blood vessels in the forebrain to constrict, forcing the blood to the hindbrain to nourish the reflex center, because this is where we're going to operate from. But basically, when you squeeze the blood vessels in the forebrain, constrict them, you shut down consciousness and intelligence. So an interesting and unwanted aspect of the stress response is that we become less intelligent when we're under stress, because there's a tendency to shut off the forebrain and really operate from reflex behavior, so that a group of people, a nation that is bathed in fear, is less intelligent than a nation that is living in growth and harmony, and will make decisions, of course, that are inappropriate at that particular time. And this may account for some of the conditions of the world that we live in right now, because the fear levels are so great. And it becomes really incumbent upon us to recognize that the perception of fear is a perception. And if we buy fears that don't really exist, our biology doesn't know the difference between a real fear and a made-up fear. And that's why I really, again, emphasize the nature of the book is called The Biology of Belief. It could be officially called The Biology of Perception. But the interesting part is, when we're responding to a fear, is it real or not? Well, I'll tell you where the difference is. From my brain down to my cells, it makes no difference if it's real or not, because they're just getting the information. So the interesting reality is, my belief, whether right or wrong, is still going to control my biology if I'm right or I'm wrong. And so it becomes incumbent upon us to recognize that our beliefs profoundly influence our health, especially if we start to believe that we are in a state of threat or our survival is in question, then there's a tendency for us to engage the HPA axis and inhibit our growth mechanisms, shut down our immune system, and become less intelligent in the process, and that this is not what biology was designed for. Biology did not see the stress mechanism as a 24/7, 365 event, that it should only be an acute event and we should be maintaining growth. Yet in the world that we have chosen, the media, the government, etc., really encourage us to live in this kind of fear, and it has great debilitation upon our physiological maintenance and our neurological and immunological characters that we express. So there's an important understanding for us, and that is, if you change your perceptions, you can change your biology. So one of the most important things that we have to start recognizing now is to get out of the fear that others would have us in, because as we buy into their fear, we will get sicker and die faster as a consequence of that.
This concludes session 4 of The Wisdom of Your Cells. Our program continues with